Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 153rd mass shooting so far in the USA in 2017, this time with the victims being a congressman, an aide, a lobbyist, and two Capitol policemen. But later today, the 154th mass shooting took place in San Francisco at a UPS facility that left four dead. Joshua Horowitz, the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea, joins us to discuss whether the unity and bipartisanship on display in the House today, as well as President Trump's call that, quote, our children deserve to grow up in a nation of safety and peace, will lead to an easing of the deadlock over gun rights versus gun safety, over the right to bear arms versus the right to be safe from gun violence. We will assess whether any change will come from this latest tragedy that hit so close to home for lawmakers, or, since the perpetrator once supported Bernie Sanders, will right-wing media fan the flames as they blame the shooting on Trump haters? Then we'll explore the broader issue of what is behind the proliferation and availability of firearms, and with so much access to data, why is it that we as a nation are unable to prevent people with a history of mental illness, or in this case, the gunman who shot the congressman, a history of domestic violence and a reckless discharge of a firearm, from getting hold of lethal military-style weaponry and causing multiple deaths and injuries? Tom Diaz, a former senior policy analyst at the Violence Policy Center and author of The Last Gun, How Changes in the Gun Industry Are Killing Americans and What We Can Do About It, joins us to discuss what is driving America's disproportionately high civilian death toll from guns. Then finally, we'll look into the siege of the tiny Gulf state of Qatar and speak with an Arabic-speaking expert on the Middle East, Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He joins us to refute the bogus claims by Donald Trump and the Saudi rulers that they are fighting terrorism and confronting Iran, when in fact it is all about the self-preservation of autocratic monarchs who can't stand the freedom of expression on Al Jazeera and want to spread Saudi Wahhabism to dominate the Gulf. And joining us now is Joshua Horowitz, the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He has spent more than two decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Horowitz.
Thanks for having me, Ian. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Joshua. And of course, again, it feels like Groundhog Day in terms of revisiting the conversation about gun freedom or whatever the expression is and gun safety or gun control. And clearly, even though the Congress has taken a recess after some stirring speeches by Paul Ryan and Nancy Pelosi, that we're all Americans, we're all together, etc., a very moment of unity for sure, but it, I suspect it's going to be a fleeting moment. And again, I expect we'll be back with the polarization. Those will be arguing, well, if it wasn't for the fact that the Capitol Police were armed, a lot more congressmen would have been killed, and so therefore we all need to arm ourselves. And then on the other side, the arguments will be that this fellow who had a history of violence and is clearly perhaps mentally unstable should not be able to buy a gun. So is there a chance that something good will come out of this? We all live in hope, Josh.
Well, I doubt this will come out some type of policy change in Congress. That's probably not in the cards when it comes to firearms. I do hope, though, that this leads people to more dialogue on Capitol Hill. Today it appears, and I use that, you know, in quotes, because we don't know really all the facts, that it may be someone who was on the left who was involved in the shooting, and in the past someone involved on the right, but they have all something in common, and that is that they have a history of behavioral indicators that indicate that they will be violent. And I hope that we can have a discussion about that and what that means. But I think as far as, you know, sort of Congress making some big changes about this, I suspect that's not in the cards. I do think, as I continue to think, and I think I've told you in the past, that the action today in general and on policy and other changing gun violence prevention is in the states. And I do think that these types of incidents do impact that discussion.
Well, we started out the day with 152 mass shootings in this country in 2017. The 153rd took place this morning in Arlington, Virginia. And then shortly thereafter, the 154th incident of gun violence unfolded in San Francisco, where there were at least four deaths. So this is the real issue, isn't it? The extraordinary statistics in this country of gun violence compared to all other developed nations.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're in a rolling tragedy after tragedy in the United States, and I think the one thing that we need to understand is that you just mentioned a large number, 150 something, and people are focused on their TV all day today, looking at Congress and saying, "Well, did I know about these other ones?" And I think we've become somewhat numb to the other things going on. We were shocked out of that for a moment today because it happened to be a member of Congress. But I can tell you that if it was just the UPS shooting today, or just a shooting in one of the urban centers where I live here in Virginia, it wouldn't have got coverage all day on CNN and Fox and MSNBC. It would have been, one of those things we missed. And I think we've become extraordinarily numb to these things. But I think it's time to break out of our complacency. And that's because for the first time in a decade or so, the gun violence death rate and injury rate is going up dramatically. And we better get a hold on this quickly if we want to stop this carnage.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Horowitz, who is the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He has spent more than two decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. Now, you mentioned that this shooter has a left-wing background. I'm not sure how serious one can analyze his politics, but he was apparently a Bernie Sanders supporter, and Bernie Sanders has taken to the Senate floor to repudiate any connections to this fellow who apparently worked on the campaign. He seems to have had a position about taxing the rich and attacked the trickle-down policies of Reagan, and then also attacked Bush and Cheney as war profiteers. None of that is radical politics by any stretch of the imagination, but that's not the issue, is it? I mean, it's one thing. You can have any position in politics. When you pick up a gun and shoot people, that's not about politics.
No, it's not about politics. It's about and what you see in many of these shootings, and you see when Gabby Giffords was shot, you saw the shooters be people who have a history of violence, a history of arrest, a history of trouble. And that's exactly what happened today. And to me, that is by far the most salient factor. We don't know all the issues yet, and I want to be careful with this, but it's been reported that he had been involved with domestic violence, that he had other arrests, that he had threatened his stepkids, things like that. And those are the indicators of someone who is violent. And what we need to ask in all the shootings, not just perpetrated by potentially someone on the left or the right, but why in America are the tools of mass lethality put into these people's hands with such ease? That's really the question for us. We're going to have angry, violent people in the United States, but we put an assault weapons in their hands that makes those folks so much more dangerous. And we all have to own up to the fact that we've made it too easy. And we're not going to stop people from being angry or violent, but we can stop them from combining that anger with a lethal assault weapon, and that must be something that we concentrate. We have given too much lethality, too much firepower to people who are showing signs of being dangerous.
Well, the president spoke earlier today, and I thought he was actually quite eloquent, and he did mention the need for us as Americans to be safe in the streets and children being safe in the streets. And I thought for a moment there that that was an interesting thing, possibly that could be built on, that an indication that, that maybe he does get it. Maybe that, you know, the argument seems to come down to the idea of the Second Amendment is, gives you freedom to have a gun, but it also talks about a well-regulating militia being necessary for a free state. Well, we can't be a free state if we're always in fear of gun violence. So the issue then comes down to the rights of an individual to have guns versus the rights of all citizens to be free from gun violence.
Well, that's true. That's true. So that, I mean, I think there's definitely a balancing that needs to be done here. And I think the freedom to be safe is a very important freedom. Domestic tranquility is built into the foundational lines of the Constitution. So I think it's something that we should take very, very seriously. And that's really the purpose of government is to increase public safety and domestic tranquility. But let me just say that, you know, you mentioned Second Amendment as people say it's a right to own a gun. Well, it's gone so much farther than that. And so that people in this Congress, like Rand Paul, have said, oh, the Second Amendment, it's about Second Amendment remedies. It's about having the ability to, you know, use guns to get our way in the political process and to fight government tyranny. I can tell you, though, that, you know, one man's health care may be another person's tyranny, right? And so of course, they said this all when President Obama was in the White House. So they've sort of, you know, I think the NRA especially and some of their minions have built the idea that it's okay to use guns in the political process. And, you know, there's another word for that. That's called terrorism. And I think it's very important that gets rolled back to I think to the meaning where we can have actually a discussion, because we can't have a discussion if there are members who think that Second Amendment remedies is okay, because you saw that today. That's
exactly
not okay.
Right. James Hodgkinson, if his politics are relevant, which they're not, but they will be made relevant because of our political polarization, he has taken it upon himself, this idea of a Second Amendment remedy, right?
Right. And we need to roll that idea back. We need to roll that back so we get to a discussion about balancing individual safety and rights against public safety, right? We need to get, that's where we should have this discussion. And I think if we can get to that space, there is a lot we can do, right? Because there are people who want to have a firearm for self-defense, and I think there's ways to accommodate that with the proper training and a permit to purchase and things like that. But if the right extends to shooting people who you disagree with, we got nothing to talk about. We're not in the same space. And so I think we need to roll back and to look at this. Let's try to balance these rights, this right, in a much more intelligent and pragmatic way. There's no way that the Constitution could say could validate shooting government officials, because at that point it's a suicide pact, and our founders weren't that stupid. So I think it's really important to understand that we need to have a much more civil discussion. And I think when you asked me at the beginning of the show what made this accomplish, I think that discussion may be rolled back to, okay, how do we balance the need for individual self-defense with the need for individuals to feel safe in their own communities?
So do you think there's a way to build upon what President Trump said today? In other words, that he said we've got to be able to be safe in our streets and our children have to be safe. My fear is that already there are signs that this is going to end up increasing political polarization, in the sense that Donald Trump's son has already said that there's a connection between the Julius Caesar play that has a character that looks like playing Julius Caesar that looks like Donald Trump. That's to blame for this incident. Other Republicans are saying that it's the hatred of Trump that's out of control in the country and it's led to this shooting. So there are signs, conflicting signs here, from the president himself, the possibility of something hopeful in terms of a serious and useful national debate, about the very issues that we're talking about, the freedom to have a gun versus the freedom not to be shot in the streets, and then this other politically charged stuff that's coming out. You're there in Washington, D.C., Josh. What are you seeing?
Well, we're seeing, I'm seeing a lot of sort of NRA rhetoric from members. Oh, we need more guns. And, like, you know, if the Capitol Police weren't there, who was going to, we would have to have our own guns. But of course, you know, in Virginia, Virginia where I live, in Alexandria, where this happened, this is a very gun-friendly state. People can have guns in these locations. It wasn't a gun-free zone. But people want to use this to make the argument that we need more firearms. I do think President Trump's statement has a kernel of hope. I think for him, the problem is that he's so all over the place. They can say one thing one minute and then be influenced by the next person that talks to him. It's hard to know if there's any real core there. I will say that before he started running for president, you know, he was supportive of gun violence prevention issues. But, you know, during the campaign, he got endorsed early by the National Rifle Association. And I think that his sons seem to be very involved in big game shooting and are involved with the NRA. So I think it would take a step away from that to really get into any type of sort of hoping from this statement. But I do think he hit something that is core to all Americans, and I think that's something that we should build on, which is that we all want to be safe on our streets, in our own communities, and that there's a complicated ecosystem that we live in to make ourselves safe, and that means compromises and trade-offs, and that's really what we should be getting at right now. What are the things we need to do to make us safe?
And in terms of, you've already suggested earlier, Joshua Horowitz, that it's not likely that there'll be any legislation coming forward, certainly not in terms of gun safety. Obviously, you mentioned that there's talk about more guns. That may well be the way the House responds. But I recall, of course, Barack Obama after Sandy Hook. There was nothing more obscene than a bunch of children being massacred in their kindergarten, and yet Obama himself, at times breaking down into tears, or at least holding back tears, was just furious that he could not get anything through the House. He just simply, he couldn't shame them. So what's the problem then in terms of the disparity? There's no more than 5 million people in the NRA. They don't represent America. What's wrong with the rest of us? Why can't there be a real counter-lobby, if you will, for parents who don't want their kids hit by a stray bullet?
There is now a very powerful counter lobby that I'm proud to be part of, and I think that we are making our voices very loud and very clear, and making a lot of change all over the country. No one's making change in Congress, so I think people, you know, it's right now Congress is for many reasons at basically absolute gridlock. Nothing's happening. People, you know, they can barely pass spending bills to keep the government open. So I think we cannot measure our success or the power of a gun violence prevention movement by what's going on in Congress. But let me tell you what happened last night in the state of Virginia. When I first started working in Virginia, I live in Virginia, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you know, even Democratic politicians would run away from me. They would say, great issue, but don't make me talk about it because it's a loser, okay? So last night, our lieutenant governor, Ralph Northam, won the Democratic nomination for governor, running on gun violence prevention. He made it the centerpiece of his campaign. He pulled a lot of Republicans into his ranks winning last night. And he is not only is he not afraid to talk about it, he leads with this issue. We're going to have a big test of that in November when the NRA will oppose him. But in a state like Virginia, we have completely changed the politics of guns. And when that happens, the nation's next. We need to do that around the country, and it is happening around the country. But far from running from us now, politicians in Virginia run to us. And what can I do? How can I help? It's completely changed. And if it's changing in Virginia, it's going to change in the country. And the reason is because the gun violence prevention movement is well organized, well funded, and well thought of. And change is coming. And what I can tell your listeners, especially if, you know, I know you're in California Public Radio. I know California's done a great job. We need to spread what's happening in California around the country to states around the country. once states start changing, then Congress will start changing. And it's happening. It's just maddeningly slow and painful to watch the shootings every day. But I can tell you that I am very proud to be part of a strong, healthy gun violence prevention movement.
Well, Joshua Horowitz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're absolutely welcome, and I'll come back anytime.
Thank you, Joshua. And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Horowitz, the Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He has spent more than two decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. We're going to take a restation break and back exploring the broader issue of what is behind the proliferation and availability of military-style weapons.
He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot as cars.
Now there's a woman on my block just sits there facing the hill, saying, who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away? Whose life's a kid? Now he's hell-bent for destruction."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Tom Diaz, who's a writer, lawyer, and public speaker on the gun industry and gun control, formerly senior policy analyst at the Violence Policy Center. He has been featured on MSNBC, NPR, and other national media, and is the author of Making a Killing. And his latest book just out is The Last Gun: How Changes in the Gun Industry Are Killing Americans and What Will It Take to Stop It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Diaz.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Tom. And with the Congress having stirring speeches from House Leader Paul Ryan and Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, where they're all coming together as Americans, not as Democrats and Republicans, an attack on one is an attack on all, etc., is that going to translate into any meaningful legislation on the central issue, which seems to be clear, although often ignored, if not more often than not ignored, and that is guns were involved in this? On the one hand, the people on the pro-gun side will say, well, the fact that the cops were armed saved the day, there would have been a greater massacre. And then on the gun safety or gun control side, people will argue, well, this person who had these guns clearly was mentally unfit to own a gun, and therefore we should have gun control. So will there be meaningful legislation, or will we go back to the same debate?
Oh, I don't think there'll be any meaningful legislation. And I think you've put your finger on the operative facts. This is political theater, and both sides are going to assume their customs role and play it out. But I personally think that the problem has metastasized. We're in a whole new phase with this whole issue of guns. It's become a really horribly convoluted problem, and I don't see either side really wanting to engage this issue in a way that would make change. It sounds extraordinarily cynical, I know that, but I think both sides, I'm talking about the political sides of this issue, understand that they cannot, for political reasons, or they either don't have the ability on the gun control side, or they don't want to go against their base on the pro-gun side. So I just don't think that there is a foreseeable political solution to this problem. My own view is that it's symptomatic of a much, much bigger problem in our society, and I think it accounts for some of the division, and that is, I think our national cultural myth is broken. Societies define themselves in ways that you can't really touch. You know, we have intellectual and emotional constructs that we create, and we say, well, this is us as a nation, and this is us as a people, and I think it's become increasingly clear that we cannot unite around that kind of view, and I think it's affected our political process. It's affected the way that we look at problems. It's even affected our confidence that we can understand problems. So what do I think will happen here? I think there will be some very nice speeches. I think that there will probably be, as one congressman from Georgia has already suggested, a congressman named Loudermilk, that there'll be some special provision for members of Congress to go about armed. That's to me the only likely legislative change, wherever they are. And then the rest will sink back into this kind of new normality. I have to point out that there was a shooting in San Francisco today. I can't remember the numbers, four or five people, maybe counting the shooter. And that would probably have been the lead gun story in the news today, but for this congressional shooting. So,
right, and only a couple of days ago did we observe the one-year anniversary of the Orlando massacre in Florida.
Exactly, yeah. So. And there was just yesterday news, at least in Washington, about, if you recall, the so-called Pizzagate incident where a man showed up and actually fired his gun but didn't inflict any wounds. It could have been much worse. And that has just become disappeared now. We think about these things serially for about a couple hours a day, unless it's something really big, maybe a couple of days, and then it'll go away. But I have to keep going back to this problem is now much bigger than saying, well, let's ban assault weapons, because we are not going to do that. Let's have background checks. Background checks are a wonderful prophylactic device, but they're not perfect. And besides which, the background check systems that exist and are likely to exist have serious flaws that we're not going to fix because of opposition from the NRA and the gun industry, and so on. I can go through the whole list of things that have been proposed as remedies in the past, some of which I think would have worked, say, 20 years ago. If when the original assault weapons ban was passed by Congress, if that had actually worked, what it would have done at that period of time would have turned the gun industry into other channels of commerce. I mean, other designs, other ways to sell guns. And that might have made a difference. I'm not sure, but I think we certainly could have turned off the valve on assault weapons. And I think it's way too late to think that's going to happen now. There are way too many of them. They've moved into the mainstream, and that's just not going to happen.
Let's talk about the role of the gun industry, which doesn't come up enough in these discussions. And as I say, I hate having these discussions because it usually means that a bunch of people are being killed and you keep going back. It's like Groundhog Day. You keep going back to the same discussions and it's just heartbreaking. And as you recall, after the Sandy Hook shooting, President Obama broke down in tears in expressing his outrage and his frustration that he couldn't get a gun control bill through the Congress because of the NRA. But the NRA is just the lobbying arm of the gun industry, isn't it? Isn't that what's driving it? It's the gun industry.
Yep. I think that's a fair statement. Of course, the NRA will say, no, we're not. We represent individual gun owners. And then people will show the polls and say, well, no, the members of the NRA don't agree with many of its positions. But one power that does agree with the NRA is the gun industry. The gun industry is in this just as any other industry is, to make money. And the products that we have become flooded with are in our homes, in our communities, in the nation at large, because they make money for certain companies and certain groups of people, and they're not going to take their foot off the throttle. And they're very effective. They have the National Rifle Association and other groups that they're affiliated with. And the dynamic of the gun industry, the idea that you have to sell, as a guy named William Ruger once said, you have to have lots of new things to sell people because, like any other consumer product, people want the newest and the latest version. And that drives them to design, manufacture, and market whatever sells. And lethality is what sells most. So, yeah, the gun industry, and it's not just the American gun industry. That's the ironic part about our current occupant of the White House's American first point of view. A lot of these guns come in from foreign countries, Austria, or at least they're owned by that, and Eastern European countries, and even from Russia. So, mm-hmm.
You mean Glock being the Austrian company you're referring to?
Yeah, Glock has a manufacturing facility or facilities in the United States, but essentially it's an Austrian country, and there are others. There are many foreign gun manufacturers. I researched one that was even from the United Arab Emirates, sells a handgun in the United States. So the reason for that is, as once been said, we're the last great market in the world where civilians can be armed in such vast quantities. Now, we know that there are countries that are in ongoing conflicts, and of course there, civilians have access to arms, and it's typically for factional reasons or criminal reasons. But in the United States, it's the only market in the world where just, you know, the average person thinks nothing extraordinary about going to their local gun store and buying weapons that are really indistinguishable in all practical functional ways from military firearms. So where are you going to sell the guns you make? You're going to sell them here.
Well, we don't know yet. I guess the shooter in this incident that took place in Arlington, Virginia, at the baseball field where the Republican team was practicing for Thursday's charity event between a baseball game between the Democrats and Republicans, this fellow James Hodgkinson, I don't know what the background on the purchase of the guns that he had, but he did have a record of domestic violence. He was arrested in 2006 for domestic battery, criminal damage to property, reckless discharge of a firearm, and yet he apparently was able to get guns. So if that's always been the problem, isn't it, that there's no interface between records kept on people who have mental problems, psychiatric problems, that deem them by all reasonable means unfit to own firearms, or people with a history of violence like this fellow? That's where the system breaks down, to my mind, in this country.
It certainly breaks down if you look at it from the point of view of, let's do background checks, and what everybody says they agree, well, guns should be kept out of the wrong hands. But then there are two problems. One is an operational problem, as you point out, that there's lots of information. I hesitate to call it data, but there are lots of records all over the United States about people who have had either instances demonstrating violent tendencies or even mental illness, but those are not connected in a coherent way. And what happens when funding is proposed or programs are suggested to make this into an integrated system, then the pro-gun side says, well, wait a minute now. And then it degenerates into an argument about, well, what is really qualifying? What should really disqualify a person from owning or having access to a firearm? So you get into lots of little detailed arguments about that. Probably the most notable example currently is members of the military who have PTSD, and the argument on their side is, well, when we come back and get cured, we should have access to guns. So there's that argument about what qualifies, and then there's the whole argument about, well, you're creating some kind of national database, and that's a bad thing. And I think the best example of that is the tremendous difficulty of getting people who are at least suspected of being terrorists by the agencies responsible for investigating, i.e. the FBI and Homeland Security, to try to get them on the "you can't buy a gun" list, and this is routinely opposed. So it sounds nice to say we want background checks and we don't want people who shouldn't have guns to have guns, but when you get down into the nitty-gritty of agreeing on what to do, then these convenient arguments are raised and we make no forward progress with the ball.
And of course that argument again was brought up at the time when it became so absurd that people on the no-fly list who the authorities deemed to be too dangerous to be put on an airplane because of potential terrorist ties, they're nevertheless allowed to buy guns in the United States. So
right, and that's wholly aside, Ian, from the whole problem of this vast second market that's not subject to any of these background checks in large states that don't have effective regulation, which California does, but in many states, I could just put in an ad in a newspaper. I'm not selling through a federal dealer. I don't have to, and I'm selling it intrastate within the state, and anybody can come and buy it, and we have a transaction out of the trunk of my car or in the living room of my home, and I sell this gun. I have no idea what that person's mental state or intentions are. And even in California, unfortunately, as you know, from the Christmas Day shootings a couple years ago, the Christmas party shooting, that you can get a neighbor who gets himself ultimately in a lot of trouble, but you can get a third party to do this. So, yeah, it's very complex, and this is why I say we can see what the problems are and what the remedies that I personally think are rational, but we cannot move to the solution of those.
Well, but just in the last couple of minutes then, Tom Diaz, the data that you say exists, and it does exist, there's an enormous amount of data everywhere, particularly now in this surveillance economy with Google and Facebook and everybody else making records of everything you do, every comment you make on email or on your iPhone, etc. So there's no shortage of data. My understanding is that the relevant data that would be able to screen out people that shouldn't have guns, the ATF, the government agency in charge of firearms, interdiction and explosives, etc., they are routinely crippled by the NRA through the Congress, and they're not even allowed to use computers. They have to use old handwritten cards.
Yeah, that is, again, a story that's been told, but it's so incredible, it's almost impossible to believe that in this age where, as you properly point out, every time we go online and buy something or have some interaction, vast organizations beyond our knowledge of even who they are have all that data. But the Bureau of ATF is expressly forbidden to keep national databases. So when they do the tracing check, when a gun is used in a crime, and try to find out what was the chain of custody, who bought it, where, and why, they literally have warehouses full of boxes of paper records that people have to go through by hand. It's like something from the really not much different from, let's say, bills of lading in the late 19th century. That's how they have to do it. And that is absolutely as a result of the National Rifle Association's activity on the Hill and on the Congress. And that the argument there is, well, if we had a national database, they would come and take our guns, which is, when you think about their own power, ludicrous. But that's the way it is, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which runs the online background system, is forbidden from keeping records longer than a very ephemeral period of time. So, that's the state of play. But again, I go back to you and I, and maybe millions of other people would agree on one side, but there are millions of others on the other side, and I think it's because our national myth, I'm going back to that point, is broken. This is how we've gotten ourselves into this situation. We're so thoroughly divided that we generate absolutely contradictory narratives of what happened. The congressman from Georgia says it's a bad guy, and if my assistant had the gun he usually carries in Georgia, it would have been over very quickly. Somebody else says this person was obviously at least mentally disposed in such a way that he should not have access to a firearm, even if he were not mentally ill, and that we should have a system to stop that. But we can't connect those two things together. And to me, it's not just gun control. I mean, what's going on in Washington every day now is just expressive of this broken national self-image. We don't know who we are, what we stand for, and we have come increasingly under this current administration to doubt even our understanding of what's happening, what's fake news, what's real news, people say is very cleverly manipulated, and some I think is just a consequence of the situation we find ourselves in.
Right, but there's nothing more real than the bullet. And I think,
absolutely.
I thank you for joining us here today, Tom Diaz.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Tom Diaz, who's a writer, lawyer, and public speaker on the gun industry and gun control, formerly a senior policy analyst at the Violence Policy Center. He's the author of Making a Killing, and his latest book is The Last Gun, How Changes in the Gun Industry Are Killing Americans and What It Will Take to Stop It. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the siege of the tiny Gulf state of Qatar.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. And he has an article at grahamefuller.com. Does Qatar really threaten the Gulf? Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And you basically have Donald Trump and the boy king in Saudi Arabia both rattling the saber here. We, of course, all saw recently Donald Trump doing the sword dance. They've gone from dancing with a sword to rattling the saber, I guess, over the tiny Gulf state of Qatar. And the excuses they're using is they're saying that the rulers of Qatar are supporters of terrorism and that they're too close to the Iranians. But your article points out, and I think it's very important for people to read this article, is that really this, you have to go back to the 1990s when Al Jazeera first emerged on the world stage, and it provoked the joke in the Arab world that Qatar is a small country in the Persian Gulf and Al Jazeera is its capital. So elaborate on that, if you will, the influence of Al Jazeera.
Yeah, it is a tiny state. It's just a little tiny peninsula. Hardly anybody even looks at maps of those places. It's a tiny little peninsula sticking off the Arabian Peninsula, bordering on Saudi Arabia, and probably could be conquered by Saudi Arabia in 24, 48 hours if it ever came to that. But so this little place, in 1996, they launched a satellite news broadcast called Al Jazeera, and this satellite's program suddenly blew apart the old Arab world, Arab dictator-controlled media with, you know, very vibrant interviews. No topic was taboo. It was the first time for the Arab world to have international news in Arabic. Up to that time, if you were an Arab and you wanted to hear our international Arab news, all there was BBC and Voice of America with their own predictable slant. So Al Jazeera galvanized everything, and because of its openness and discussion of Islam and Arab nationalism, etc. It enraged so many of the Gulf leaders because it put them in a very awkward position and wiped them off the map in terms of their own television and radio institutions. So there's always been some resentment against Qatar as being a feisty, independent little place that has sort of told it like it is in the Arab world. The Arab public loves it because it's close to their heart. It represents views that they associate with, but the regimes hate it. And that legacy is still around. And if you read what the Saudis and the UAE are currently saying, one of their stipulations is you got to get rid of Al Jazeera or muzzle it.
And the U.S. has not exactly been enlightened in its attitude to Al Jazeera because it's been critical of the U.S.'s intervention, particularly in Iraq, which was hardly a success. But Al Jazeera actually showed the carnage as a result of our war. We here in the land of the free and the home of the brave accepted censorship in as much as we never saw pictures of dead Americans and dead Iraqis.
But exactly. It's been a Nintendo game, shock and awe from, 20,000 feet, but not the human impact, the human suffering that any war inflicts.
And that may have something to do with the fact that the Al Jazeera offices were mistakenly bombed twice by the U.S. in Afghanistan and in Baghdad. But in general, now you already have it so openly where you've got Donald Trump claiming credit for this siege of Qatar, saying that his recent trip to Saudi Arabia, this is something that they worked out. Well, clearly there's a de facto alliance here between the Saudis, the Israelis, and the Egyptian military government, and the U.S. is joining it. And is the U.S. the protagonist in this alliance, or are they just following Israel's cues?
I think it's more following Israel's cues. And furthermore, I mean, it's the same old mantra that the Saudis have been now pushing for to several decades, which is that the falls of most of the guilt for most of what's wrong in the Middle East really goes back to the door of Iran. It's the wicked Persians, it's the wicked Shiites, and that's the optic through which they see it. I'm afraid that much of the U.S. government, but certainly the U.S. Congress, has been long since talked into the fact that Iran is perceived as the greatest terrorist threat in the world, which on analysis and breakdown is essentially pretty flimsy statement. Iran supports a lot of movements that we don't like, and yes, some of them are violent, but none of them are movements like Al-Qaeda or ISIS. There are things like Hezbollah, which is a largely Lebanese political movement. It's a political party. It participates in the government. And Hamas, which is a Sunni movement. It runs the government. It has elections. It runs the government. And yes, it has engaged in armed struggle against Israel in the past. So because that is the basis, essentially, of why Iran is accused of supporting terrorism. But it's not a very good case. There's a much better case to be made that Saudi Arabia indirectly is supporting terrorism through propagation of its virulently ugly and radical Wahhabi ideology all over the world.
So the other reason, the real reason why there's an opposition to Qatar is because not just Al Jazeera, which is spreading news and information and dialogue, which none of these repressive military regimes or these medieval monarchies can tolerate. It's also, from Israel's point of view, it's because, well, first of all, from the Saudis' point of view, anything that competes with a medieval kleptocracy that they have, this family rule, has to be stamped out. And so they're afraid of political Islam in general. And it's the Muslim Brotherhood that is their bugaboo. It's also the Israelis, because Hamas is a protege of the Muslim Brotherhood. So at the end of the day, Is this what's going on here, that they're all ganging up on this tiny little place?
Yeah, I don't want to suggest that, you know, that Qatar is the, you know, the angel of perfection. I mean, the fact is, Qatar is a monarchy. It's not a democracy. They have no intention of being a democracy. But it's a much, much more open society. It even embraces Wahhabism, but its society is far, far more open than Saudi Arabia. Women work, women drive cars, they have cinemas. They have, you know, sexes often are mixing in public affairs. There are you can get a drink in a number of places in Qatar. None of this. There's art museums, quite stunning art museums in Qatar, Western and Eastern art. And there are six, I believe, Western universities, including Georgetown University, that have campuses in Qatar. So it's a far livelier, more enlightened place than Saudi Arabia. But the Qataris also have been throwing money into some of the radical jihadi movements in Syria in their own effort to get rid of the Sunni government. So even they are not without blemish in this.
Sure. And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. His latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. And he has an article at GrahamEFuller.com. Does Qatar really threaten the Gulf? So this looks like an attempt at regime change, throttling this tiny little country, blockading it, putting it under siege, stopping air traffic, cutting off its food supplies, etc. It doesn't seem to be working, though. And this obviously is the work of this boy king in Saudi Arabia, who's turned out to be quite aggressive in Yemen, where he's bogged down. Of course, the irony is that the Saudis' royal family are so suspicious of any challenge to their authoritarian rule that they don't even have a military. They split it up into three components. So they're turning out to be kind of useless on the battlefield. And I think they're asking.
Yeah, that's right. And furthermore, the Saudis have been more than attempting. They are the de facto regional hegemon in the Arabian Peninsula. And other smaller states all the way around the periphery there accept Saudi's preeminence, but they are also made nervous by Saudi schemes of herding everyone together into one security organization or one view on everything. This is actually, it's interesting, there's more unanimity this time between the UAE and Saudi Arabia than we've seen in the past. But I don't think any of these Gulf states really want to be dominated by the Saudis in every capacity. Kuwait has sat this whole thing out. So has Oman. They will not join up in the anti-Qatari struggle. And I think they all recognize that if it's Qatar today, it could be them tomorrow if they invoke the wrath of the kingdom against them. I somehow don't think this is going to work. I could be wrong, but I think even Washington, I think people in Washington who bother to be informed on this, and there are many in the State Department and the Pentagon and CIA, are going to recognize that this is something of a phony campaign and crusade, and that given the fact that Qatar, apart from very good relations with Iran, also hosts the biggest American base in the entire Middle East, at Al Udeid, I think Washington is going to take it easy before they jump on any bandwagon designed to change regimes in Qatar. Who knows?
Well, you've already seen, Graham, you've already seen Tillerson trying to calm the roiling waters and Trump inflaming the situation. And you didn't mention the Turks as well. The Turks are supporting.
I don't think Trump really obviously doesn't understand the full depth of the problem, but I think he's simply operating on the fact that Qatar is a friend of Iran, and we're unhappy with Iran, so therefore the Qatari regime has to be not evil, but due for a regime change. I don't know that we're really going to get on board with that program fully, but he's very mercurial and I suspect his advisors will suggest that this isn't the most well-thought-out plan that the Saudis are operating from. And, of course, as you pointed out, Turkey itself is supporting Qatar absolutely, even with militarily. They're sending troops and food and, I don't know, money or whatever, diplomatic backing. So it's divided the area, and I think it's going to turn out to be probably another blunder by the aggressive boy king, as you called him, not yet king, but aspiring.
Right. Well, but if I were the Qataris, I'd still be worried, though, because look what's happened in Bahrain. The Saudis essentially invaded and they control it, and there's apparently some hideous human rights abuses going on there that are not getting any international attention. So there's a really ugly side to Saudi dominance, and unfortunately, we've turned a blind eye, as you mentioned, to the effect of Wahhabism around the world. Look what's happening in Indonesia, one of the least austere of the Muslim lands, the most pluralistic. They had a Christian governor of Jakarta, and the Wahhabis drove him out. So, you know, I don't understand, and used to work at the top level of the CIA, why are we so blind to what the effects of Saudi Wahhabism having spread around the world, not just spawned Al-Qaeda and ISIS, but also affected, created the Taliban, destabilized Pakistan, arguably, and now is even undoing the political and social harmony in Indonesia, the largest Muslim country.
Yeah,
on the planet.
Well, I think Saudi Arabia has been doing this for many, many, many years, not supporting terrorism as such, but as supporting Wahhabi views, which are extremely austere, very harsh, very anti-Western, very narrow, very intolerant of any other view, not only Christianity or Judaism or Buddhism. They are intolerant of any other sect or group within Islam itself. So they've been doing this a long time, but you know, Ian, the cost had not been sufficient for the U.S. or the West to really lean on them in this respect. I mean, after all, Saudi Arabia was a good market for huge military sales, et cetera, et cetera. 9/11, of course, changed that considerably with the fact that the majority of the terrorists in 9/11 were Saudi. But, you know, it still remains a massive source of purchase for American military equipment, and it's still a huge producer of oil. So I think the simple-minded view would be, look, we don't want to rock our relations with Saudi Arabia. Yeah, we'll lean on them a little bit, but I think that's changing. I think there's a recognition now. I see it even in the press or in the West in general, that Saudi Arabia is a very, very dangerous element, even though it's not directly supporting terrorism. It's indirectly more responsible probably than any other single factor in the world.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. His latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. And he has an article at GrahamEFuller.com. Does Qatar really threaten the Gulf? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.